Frank Burris is the author of The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. It's a book that combines travel writing, medical history, and an exploration of anthropology. Frank Burris, good morning, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's a very interesting book to read. I was going to ask just right off the top, how would you define the geography of madness?
The geography of madness is sort of a term to imply that, you know, where you live can determine, you know, the illnesses that you have. And so the book is kind of an exploration of that and how the places you live and the people that are surrounding you kind of affect us in ways that we don't really understand or appreciate.
And how did you get interested in this topic?
I first got interested in this topic when, in about 2001, I saw some stories on the BBC about magical penis theft in West Africa, where, you know, an individual would feel like his genitals had been stolen sort of magically by someone, and then would like see someone who he thought maybe did it, and then that person would be accused and sometimes lynched by a mob. And there was, I think, two stories at least in 2001 of this happening in Nigeria and Benin, and I just thought it was fascinating. You know, I didn't think, I was not in a ridiculous kind of way, but I just thought it was really interesting, and, you know, wondered what it would be like to live in kind of a world where that sort of thing were possible.
Do these sorts of things happen and stick around for long periods of time, or this sort of cultural madness, is it something that comes and goes?
It seems to come and go a little bit. It's kind of always around. I mean, depends which thing you're talking about. With the sort of panics, the sort of mass genital panics, they seem in Nigeria and also in China, they seem to kind of come in waves every 10 years or so.
Now, you first traveled to Nigeria to, if I remember correctly, to investigate penis thieves, right?
Right.
And what was the reaction that you had when you were going around and trying to talk to people about this?
Well, you know, it depends. I was mostly hanging around with journalists who are smart guys, and, you know, they know how the world works. So at first they're a little bit embarrassed to talk about it, but then once you get sort of talking to them about different stuff, and, you know, the stories will come out from under the surface of things that have, weird things that have happened to their people they know or their aunts or stuff like that. And so, you know, you can see sort of this world kind of emerging. And I think most people don't doubt at least the possibility that this sort of thing is true, or, you know, I mean, even if they don't think maybe it's for sure true, they wouldn't want to like rule it out, you know. So you have that's kind of the culture and the narrative that are in the culture are all sort of all running along these lines. Nigeria has the third, I think, largest film industry in the world, and, you know, there will be some sort of element of magic in most of the plots of the movies.
So they're conditioned to think that way. The example of the man on the bus who felt that, I believe, the woman next to him stole his penis, was that in Nigeria?
Yeah, that was in Nigeria. That was in a place called Alagbado, which is outside of Lagos, kind of.
Tell us about that story and what unfolded there.
Well, so a friend of mine had seen this story in the paper about this guy named Wasio Karimu who had been on a bus and had felt something strange, like something was wrong with him and that his penis was like vanishing into his body or something like that. And then there was this woman who had been on the bus next to him, and she had sort of bumped into him or done something unusual, and he accused her of doing it, and then a lynch mob kind of formed around this woman, and then a sort of passing police patrol stopped the crowd from killing her and brought them both to the police station. The police like examined Wasio Karimu, and they said you're fine, and then they arrested him for falsely accusing her of this, you know. And so, so then he was in jail for a little while. Then he got out. And so, and these kind of things are in the paper on a fairly regular basis in Nigeria. You know, it stuff happens, and it's kind of annoying for police because it becomes a law enforcement issue too. But they printed his address in the paper, and so me and another guy went out there to try to just talk to him because I wanted to interview him, and we actually got kind of harassed by this gang they had at that point, what are called area boys, which are these kind of thugs that control certain areas, and you sort of have to deal with them, and they like cut off the road and were threatening to beat us and stuff like this before they finally told us the story of what happened to Wasu Karimu.
Was it difficult to get people to talk?
Not super difficult. I mean, for most people, it's their reality. You know, it's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something that's like it's not something that is a secret or anything. It's just something that happens, and you know, most people are happy to talk about it. The other guy I talked to who it had happened to was named Starry Zobazi. He was a journalist, actually, and he had been a Jehovah's Witness when this happened to him. He was walking down the street, and two guys kind of came up behind him, if I remember right, and asked him directions to some place, and then he felt this strange thing happen, and he accused, thought they had somehow, you know, stolen his penis, and so he wanted to bring them to the hospital, and he told me all this freely, you know, and he actually wrote an article about it and was convinced totally that it was real and didn't really believe in it. He said before it happened to him, since then he knows it's like a dangerous thing, and he wanted people to like watch out for it.
We're speaking with Frank Burris. He is the author of The Geography of Madness. It looks at some of the strangest syndromes in the world. He has traveled extensively and written about some of these. We'll be talking to him after the break again, so stay with us. You can join us this morning. We are speaking, with Frank Burris. The Geography of Madness is his book, and he looks at some of the world's strangest syndromes and what they mean. Our phone number for the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, or jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about this principle of people who believe that their penis has been stolen or at least shrunken and moved up into their bodies, and some people believing that that could actually cause death. When they would go to however they define a healthcare provider and they were shown their penis, was it a miraculous healing for them? Did they suddenly say, "Oh no, maybe I'm okay now"?
Well, it depends on the person, you know, it depends on the situation. But, you know, generally, like one of the Nigerian doctors who I talked to who's seen cases of this, you know, sometimes they'll start to feel better if you tell them it's not something to worry about. But a lot of times the person will, you know, look at their penis and say, well, that's not actually mine, or my, you know, it's coming back, or the essence is gone, or something like that. It's something that just feels wrong. It's more than something that you see, you know. And it's sort of like, I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to measure, you know, as it were. But you know, it would be similar to like saying, well, can you just tell an anorexic person to get on the scale and see how much they weigh, or tell a depressed person that things aren't so bad, you know? I mean, it's not so simple as just like observing the reality of the situation.
I'd like to ask a question about modern Western society and these sort of things. I want to read a short paragraph from your book. I hope I'm saying this individual's name right, Dr. Gui Al Ling, a Chinese scholar. And he's talking a little bit about the American perspective and says, at the moment, the Americans have the loudest voice. They just came out with the DSM-4 and 5 for the whole world to follow, but they're not really scientific. It's just that we think this is. And it upsets a lot of developing countries that have a lot of syndromes that are so-called culture-bound. They also tried to get into the DSM, but they were pushed out because they said they were not scientific. In India, they have even more culture-bound syndromes, but you don't find them in the DSM. They are excluded. So do a lot of people see this as sort of an American-type bias with the DSM?
Well, yes, a lot of people who are not Americans do. I mean, that's always been the issue with the cultural syndromes. They have kind of historically been put in the back, in the appendix in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is what psychiatrists use to determine who has what. And so the syndromes that we have are included in the main text, and the ones that other people have, a lot of them are included have been included in the back. That changed a little bit with the most recent edition of the DSM, but the issue is still kind of the same. And part of that issue is that, you know, we assume that our mental illnesses are purely like biological and rational, and there's no role for our beliefs in those. When most of them are syndromes, we don't know the causes. There's no biomarkers for any psychiatric illness that, you know, has been found, and so these things are all based on agreements of who all agrees that these set of symptoms add up to this syndrome.
Well, in the past, the DSM has classified female hysteria and homosexuality as a mental illness, so they have kind of a checkered past themselves, don't they?
Yeah, I mean it's always changing and always evolving, and it's actually evolving more, I think, in the direction of allowing a little bit of cultural influence. They now have a lot of the conditions now have a short cultural paragraph, and you know, there's this, in the back, they have a really good cultural formulation interview, which is meant to kind of ask patients what they think their story of their illness is, which is, you know, can be really helpful and can be a factor in the illness itself. So yeah, it is always changing. Another one that recently was called into question was seasonal affective disorder, which some people are saying should not be in there and is sort of ad hoc.
We're speaking with Frank Burris. He's the author of The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. You can join our conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. One of the things I read in your book that I laughed at was carpal tunnel syndrome and America's relationship with it. I never realized it was so complex and that our concern about it waxes and wanes. The reason I did was because back in the 1980s or 90s, I was doing a little bit of construction work, and I was pretty convinced I had carpal tunnel syndrome because the media was talking about it constantly. And I haven't thought about carpal tunnel syndrome since the 1990s. So anyway, could you give us the overview of or the history of carpal tunnel syndrome in America?
Well, that was really one of the most interesting things, I thought, because it's another example of one of these things where you'd think, I mean, it seems like it should just be a purely mechanical issue. You know, you're using your hands in a certain way. But if you look at the history of it, these things kind of come and go. Like early in the 1800s, there was a very similar condition called Reiter's palsy, and then that sort of went away. And then when telegraphs came into use, there was this thing called telegraphist cramp, and the symptoms are all really similar to carpal tunnel syndrome. But they come and then they go. And then for most of the 20th century, there were no new hand syndromes that came about, but in the in the 80s, in the meatpacking industry, there started to be this concern over repetitive injury. I can't remember the acronym, but, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome from doing the same motions over and over again. And that started to get some media attention. And then it kind of spread to other industries, like, people in newspapers and other factories and things like this. And it became sort of a thing, and more people became aware of it, and the rates started going up. And then in the late 2000s, or late, like, 1990s and early 2000s, the rates started dropping again because people just weren't concerned about it. And so it's a complicated sort of thing, because there's definitely some sort of mechanical piece of it, but there's also this other piece, which is more based on our what we expect to happen or what we understand to be happening. And so, you know, both of those things kind of interact to create this condition.
What are some other things that we see perhaps in the last few decades that have come up on the scene that might be culturally based here in America?
Culturally based? Well, I mean, there's some psychiatrists who argue that, you know, every syndrome has an element of culture to it. It's a question of the degree of how much it is, you know. And so then that question hasn't really been sorted out. But some of the more sort of heavily, that would be more heavily culturally weighted would be like multiple personality disorder is something that's kind of come and gone. There are some questions about, you know, gluten intolerance and whether that's a cultural syndrome, and, you know, or what's called a cultural idiom of distress. For quite a long time, there's been discussion about premenstrual syndrome, which, you know, is not found in the same form in a lot of other cultures, and whether that's a cultural syndrome. And, you know, to say that is not also to say that it's not real, or that it doesn't exist, or that people you and I know and love are not having it. But it is to say that it's not purely like a hormonal thing. It's also based on our understanding of the body, the meaning of the menstrual cycle, the, you know, all these complex things, which are a piece of this this process, which, you know, There's a Canadian philosopher called Ian Hacking who came up with this idea of the bile loop, which is different than our usual understanding of the body and health, where the mind and body are kind of looping together and in a sort of feedback loop that creates these things.
Would it be possible that the prevalence of a certain syndrome would be the same across many different cultures, but some cultures just don't talk about it, so it seems like it's not actually a thing, where other cultures, you know, they make a big deal out of it?
Yes, I mean, that's always possible, you know, although it's hard to find something like that doesn't differ. I mean, there are versions of depression, you know, in every culture, but they're different, they're thought of differently, the rates are different, and so the attitudes about it are different, the attitudes about whether it's, you know, bad for you or not are different. And so you have all these factors involved that are contributing to these differences. But, you know, I mean, obviously there's some underlying biological things, in America we have panic attacks, which have a certain set of symptoms that, you know, are different from what they have in Cambodia. They have what are called kyal attacks, which are wind attacks, which happen when, you know, there's in traditional Cambodian beliefs, there's this idea that there's a substance called kyal, which is like wind, which flows in your body alongside the blood, and when that becomes blocked, you have a lot of it can cause a lot of problems. And so that syndrome, the guy who researches it, Devin Hinton, you know, talks about how that syndrome is related to the biology of anxiety, but there are cultural factors that are causing it to be different also. So it's hard to sort out what the lines are and where they are. I mean, they both have some similar underlying things, but they're also different, and there's different things kind of driving them.
Join our conversation this morning on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Have you had any experience with things that seem culturally based, and have you used any medicines or alternative therapies to try to cope with those things in your own life? Love to hear from you and what might be happening. When we talk about cultural conditions that are out there, Frank, is there a difference between the sexes? Do men and women have higher rates in any particular country? Would it be higher in America for one and versus maybe somewhere else in the world?
Well, women have higher rates of premenstrual syndrome. But,
yes.
I don't know. I mean, nothing comes to mind. There is one interesting difference that I can think of, which they're not technically considered cultural syndromes, but what's called mass psychogenic illnesses, where there were a few years ago, there were those girls in Leroy, New York, who had that kind of twitching, contagious twitching thing. I don't know if you remember that.
Right.
But it was found to be a mass psychogenic illness, and those things are not super uncommon. Normally, they don't have the motor issues. It's just like a sickness, like vomiting, and those are usually one of the reasons people knew it was a mass psychogenic illness is because it mainly affected girls, and those things usually kind of affect young women who are in the same social group. And if somehow it's communicated better through those channels for some reason, that would be the only thing. I mean, obviously, men have a higher incidence of genital retraction syndrome or CORAL, but in the 90% percentile. But it does happen to women also occasionally. So it's not. And no, I don't think either sex is necessarily more susceptible to cultural influences. I think that's just how we are as humans.
When someone in a room yawns and then everybody in the room starts yawning, I mean, is this just sort of what we are like as primates? And you know, yawning is harmless, but
right. Yeah.
But is a similar type thing going on when all of a sudden one person, I know in the book you talked about one young man who thought his penis was retracting and he went to the doctor, and then the principal of the school got up and announced that and that sort of suddenly caused a panic with a bunch of young men heading off to see the doctor. I mean,
Yes, that happened in southern China in 2004 at a school where it happened to one boy, and then the next day the principal made an announcement at the school assembly that this dangerous condition was happening, and then the next day, like 64 boys came down with this genital shrinking issue. So yes, it is. I mean, it is. We hear about these things. We learn about them socially from people around us. And then, you know, it kind of opens up these it creates expectations. It changes our understanding of the causal kind of mechanisms that we believe in. And those beliefs have, you know, have effects that, you know, you can see in a lot of these conditions, you know. The symptoms, the effects are not imaginary. And that's one of the interesting things that comes out of, like, the placebo-nocebo research. You can see actually what the mechanisms are and how these things work and how, you know, when you get a placebo painkiller, your body is actually producing painkillers inside that can be reversed with a hidden administration of opiate antagonist or agonist. So you know, that's kind of, yes, that's a long sort of rambling answer to your question.
We have Brian with us in Klamath Falls, and go ahead, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wonder if Frank has thoughts on what has been called Obama derangement syndrome, where people who consider themselves conservatives, some of them believe that, they say they believe anyway, that Obama is a Muslim or born in Kenya. And it seems to be a cultural kind of thing among these people to have these beliefs. And I wonder how that fits in with the cultural syndromes. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And a lot of what I do talk about in the later half of the book is this kind of narrative issue that, you know, a lot of these things are related to the the narratives that were part of the stories that we're telling each other, and I sort of make the argument, and my feeling is that our culture is a kind of ecosystem of stories that we feel like we're part of. And to your point, you know, there are these kind of self-enclosed ecosystems of stories that are reinforcing, and when you're in those, you know, it makes perfect sense to be on the inside, just like when you're when everybody around you kind of believes something, that it seems perfectly true, you know. And that's one of the reasons we tell stories, is to convince ourselves and to convince others around us that something is true. And so those kind of networks can be very powerful, and especially if we want to be part of them. You know, that's always been the issue with, like, sort of cults and cult leaders. They create these kind of really powerful narrative ecosystems that people are part of, and it subsumes kind of their personal story to this, like, larger story.
Quickly, before we go to the break, you used to live in Oregon yourself. Do we have any strange syndromes in Oregon that we need to worry about?
I don't know. I'd have to think. I haven't thought about that, but I did. I lived in Portland for a few years. I actually worked at Powell's Books, which is a great. We do. There are probably some related to the cloud cover,
yeah,
over caffeination.
We have our own madness here, I suppose.
Right.
We're talking to Frank Burris, and his book is The Geography of Madness and How Cultural Syndromes Influence Us. You can call us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We'll take a short break here and then come back with more of your calls. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange today. I'm Milt Radford, filling in for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking this hour with Frank Burris. He is the author of the book, The Geography of Madness, subtitled Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. You can join us if you've observed some strange syndromes or have any particular things that you've often wondered about. You can give us a call here and we'll discuss those. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Frank, I have a question about some of the health fads that go around, which seem to be really popular in America and perhaps other Western countries. Is it best just to kind of ignore those and let them run their course? Or, you know, some of them, it seems like they can become very destructive. I'm not going to say bad things about the CrossFit movement, but I do have two specific friends who have both suffered some pretty significant injuries as a result of participating in that and almost obsessive about it. And so, you know, I just wonder about health fads in America.
Yes, that's it. That's a really good question. It's always hard to know, you know, when, if something is just a fad or if it's something that's going to be, you know, folded into the larger sort of body of knowledge. I mean, now you have people sort of questioning the whole, you know, low fat issue too, and so we're going back from that, even though that's what I grew up with. Our whole lives we were told to avoid fat, and now, so it does become difficult to know which advice to follow and which to not follow. So I think it is probably best just to be cautious with those things, because you don't know how it's going to pan out in the long term.
We have an email question here from JT in Eugene. He asks, will you please ask the author to explain seasonal affective disorder, SAD?
Seasonal affective disorder is it's supposed to be the illness where you know, because in the winter you have less sunshine, and so you get more depressed, and treatment includes, like, you know, vitamin D supplements, the light boxes, that sort of thing. And the study that I just read was arguing that there isn't in the darker areas where they have long winters, or they don't find higher incidences of depression than they do in lighter areas. So they were just saying that that's it's not a phenomenon. But, you know, that's not to say that people don't get depressed in the winter. I live in Minnesota, and it can be really depressing. But, you know, one of the issues probably is, you know, whether it should be considered a syndrome or an illness, or whether it's just something less than that.
Shoshona in Ashland writes this, and you'll appreciate her comment and question. She says, I grew up in Minneapolis, which is a decent, interesting, artistically vibrant place, but by 15, I couldn't wait to get out. I've tried to return to live there a couple of times in my life, and each time I find myself depressed and feeling rather crazy. Is that culture or geography or a combination? According to your frame, do individuals physically, mentally fit better into certain geographical areas?
That is a really good question. Yes, I know. I mean, the Midwest definitely has its challenges culturally, and, you know, it's not, having lived on the West Coast and the Midwest, it's not as open in a lot of ways, and it's friendly but not quite as welcoming culturally. And so it can be tough, and the winters can be tough too. But you know, another issue is your own personal story and where you see that sort of going, and where you see yourself as being. And you know, sometimes going back to the place where you started can be hard to revise kind of your what's called your personal story in that way. There's a whole thing I talk about in the book, narrative psychology theory of that all of us view our identity is kind of this story that we tell ourselves, and so that can also be a hard thing about returning to your home.
I interviewed a doctor many years ago who he was a general practitioner. And he said that on any given day up to, and he wasn't being scientifically accurate, just an anecdote. He said on any given day up to a third of his patients were exhibiting symptoms that were far exceeding whatever underlying disease they had, or they didn't have a disease at all, but they imagined it. He said he always dreaded flu season because he'd see so many people who thought they had the fear of flu and had had what he called beer flu on Monday morning. So, you know, do we see a lot of that in America as well? And I wonder if it's the same, roughly 30% who tend to be hypochondriacs or overreact to cultural things and move from one thing to another. Did you see that in any of your studies and experiences?
Definitely, there's a kind of a whole slew of like big symptoms that are attributed to a lot of diseases, a lot of syndromes, like a lot of the symptoms of PMS are the same that are listed on the side effects for fluoxetine, which is prescribed for PMS. You know, and so how do you distinguish between those two things? And one of the interesting things that I came across was this in the placebo and nocebo research, you find that you can create symptoms in people that are real by causing the expectation that they will experience them. You know, like there's a famous study from the 60s where they gave people a sugar water and said this will make you vomit, and it does. There was a study just a few years ago by Ted Kopchak at Harvard where it was on placebo acupuncture, and also I think placebo painkiller, and like they had three people that had to drop in the placebo arm that had to drop out because the side effects they were warned about were so severe, you know. And so you can actually biologically create these symptoms yourself with your own sort of expectations and beliefs, you know. And so that can become really difficult to sort out what's what.
in your book, as you spoke to different people in Asia, different countries, there seemed to be a clear difference between the older generation that relied on, for example, a traditional Chinese medicine and a younger generation that was more westernized and tended to be more scientific. And some of these particular syndromes, you know, like the Koro or whatever, had a tendency to become less prevalent as people became more educated. Is that true, or is that, you know, is that denying the cultural influence too much and trying to, you know, make it into an equation almost?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it does seem to be, you don't have any more like the mass panics in China anyway. You do still have, I mean, there are those in Nigeria, and, you know, before we get too smug about that, we should remember like things like Leroy, and there was, you know, a mass panic in Minnesota at a school where a bunch of girls got sick. And so we do also have these things, but like to your question, in China, it's really difficult to sort out. I don't have the language to really do kind of a deep dive into that thing, but it did seem like people told me that the older generation is more, it does more rely on traditional medicine, and the younger generation does rely on Western medicine. But most people use both, and in Hong Kong, for example, traditional Chinese medicine is kind of undergoing a resurgence, and the Chinese government requires, you know, all hospitals to be integrated with both. And so in people's lives, they're going to be using probably both those things to some degree. And so you have these worlds kind of coexisting in a way that's interesting, and, you know, neither one is sort of ruling out the other one, but they're sort of intermingling in a way that I don't think has happened before.
We're speaking with Frank Burris. He is the author of The Geography of Madness, looking at some of the world's strangest syndromes. If you'd like to participate, you can give us a call at the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, or jx@jeffnet.org. You can send us an email, and we can talk about these things. One thing that we haven't brought up yet is voodoo death. And, you know, I seem to recall from my childhood some terrible movie from the 1950s where there was voodoo death. So I know, and I'm sure it was not very accurate. But what is voodoo death?
Well, voodoo death is a term. It's another way of calling it is psychogenic death, or when you kind of believe that you're going to die to such an extent that you actually do. You know, and one of the first people to write about this was Walter Cannon, a psychiatrist who first came up with the idea of the fight or flight instinct. And you know, one of the cases that I came across is a good illustration of this. It was a woman who came into a hospital in Baltimore in 1967, and she was like having chest pains and nausea, dizziness, and doctors didn't know what was wrong with her. She was really anxious, and then finally she told them that she had been born on Friday the 13th, and the midwife who delivered her was what's called a root worker, or, you know, a traditional African religion that's kind of in the South. It's mixed with Native American herbalism, and the woman had said that she was going to die before her 23rd birthday, and two other girls who were born on the same day would die before their 16th and 21st birthdays. And both those girls, as it happened, one died the day before her birthday and one died on her birthday. And so this third woman was totally convinced that she was also going to die on her 23rd birthday, and then the day before her birthday she did. She just died. And so that's a sort of extreme example of that sort of thing, how that works.
So I have a question. If is overreacting, and I think maybe this goes to the story you just shared, is overreaction hardwired into the human brain? I always hear the example that if you're out on the Serengeti thousands of years ago and you see the grass rustling, you're better off assuming it's a tiger, even if it's not a tiger, for your own self-preservation. So do we have a tendency to leap toward the worst possible outcome? I guess, you know, it's Googling your medical condition in today's terms.
I mean, well, that's always the fear that the worst will happen, you know, and in insecure times, I suppose, we sort of gravitate toward that, you know, when there's a lot of unknown things. But part of it is figuring out what the chain of events is, you know, and so, and a big part of trying to understand what's happening to you is trying to, like, piece together the chain of events and look at what the causal force is there, you know, and so when you're afraid it's magic, then there's, like, nothing you can do about it, whereas if you find out that it's some other cause, it feels, like, more manageable or something, you know, so I don't know exactly how to answer that question, but it's possible, yes.
You mentioned a little bit earlier, we're talking in a Chinese context where you had the traditional medicine and modern Western medicine coming in, and they're trying to develop this balance. Do we see anything like that in America? American doctors have been very mechanistic and scientific, and you know, are doctors today embracing the idea of cultural influences that may have some kind of bearing on how they practice medicine or how they treat a patient?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to vary from doctor to doctor, but in general, I think there is the sort of idea coming in that, you know, there is more of a feedback loop than there used to be. You know, there, you have this kind of research coming from different places. You know, we used to think that genes were like IBM punch cards that you put into a machine and this thing comes out, but now we know that, you know, you can actually change your gene expression through meditation or other things, you know, and so it's not like it's not predestined, it's not predetermined. And, you know, other things like Amy Cuddy and her colleagues have found that if you arrange your body into powerful positions, it increases your level of testosterone, you know, pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And hormones are not just like something that happened to us and we have to obey, you know, we're a participant in this. So yeah, I think that it's coming around.
We've been speaking to Frank Burris today. His book is The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.